Hi, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we've got, as always, a dynamic hour for you. Don't forget, have that pad of paper and pen ready, because we'll have all kinds of good information to share with you. Here's the toll-free number that I want you to be sure to write down first if you'd like to chat later on in the hour. That toll-free number is 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Phone lines will be open later on in the program. But in the interim, we have a delightful guest, a gentleman, Jerry Winstrom. Now, he is located in the Pacific Northwest. He has experienced an intriguing journey that I don't know that many of us would have the courage to want to even consider, much less do. Now, this book that he has put out is called The Inspired Heart. It has an incredible photograph on the front of it of one of his works of art. And this is a very personal story. Not many people would have the courage to stand up and speak out and talk about this personal transformation he went through. Jerry, welcome to the show, and where are you located in the Pacific Northwest?
Thank you, Donna. I'm on Whidbey Island. It's about an hour out of Seattle.
Oh, what a gorgeous, gorgeous area that is.
Yeah, it is.
Just the perfect place for an artist.
Well, there are a lot of us here.
I can imagine. I want to share with my audience the background that you have had. Tell us a little bit about your art background. It was quite extensive, and you were a rising star. So what's your artistic background?
Well, I started out as a painter, and, you know, I at the time when I destroyed my work and changed my life, I had produced a large body of work. There was a film that was being made about my art and life, and, you know, at the sort of height of that moment. And in the 70s, you know, art in New York was God. It was sort of like became this kind of false god almost, and you could do no wrong. And I just, you know, at the moment when it should have given me everything I thought it was supposed to give me, it began to fail, and I just felt like there was something, you know, limited about the way I was going about it. So, you know, starting out as a studio painter with an enormous body of work and finally getting to the place where I felt it no longer served my sense of purpose and growth, I destroyed the work, gave everything I owned away, and lived that way for the next 15 years.
Now, I want to mention a comment. Your foreword in the book is by Thomas More. And one of the sentences in the second paragraph is, "You took the way of the holy fool, the one who grasps the simple idea that being open to life is ultimately more rewarding than trying to control it, and that you undertook this spiritual journey outside of any ancient tradition or modern system." And he felt that if he asked you the question, "Under whom did you study on this journey that you took for 15 years?" he would expect you to answer, "It's difficult to say." And that was sort of like a tongue-in-cheek remark. How did you come to know Thomas More?
Oh, through a friend, another author friend, Laura Chester, who did a book, you know, that she featured a tower I built called Holy Personal. It's about people's personal sacred spaces that they built around the U.S., and so it was through her.
Now, with your book, to go through the journey, which is what your book does for the reader, we're taking on this journey with you, and you just mentioned that you had destroyed all your art. Now, the year, the very first sentence in your introduction is, "In 1979, I destroyed all the art I had created, gave everything I owned away, and began a new life." And this was a test that you were putting yourself through. Most people would do it for 2 days and say, "That's enough, forget it, I'm on my way." What made you choose to do this for 15 years?
Well, it was the power of the event. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do it for 2 seconds if I didn't feel held by some larger reality. you know, and I think there were certainly times of doubt. But, you know, I think at those moments, and, you know, in the cyclical nature of life, we all come up against a place where everything we think we are and we think we know and, you know, or all of our everything we think we have available, like mind and will and intelligence, all fail. And, you know, at those moments where I had those doubts, something would always come through that was truly miraculous. And, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do it for that long if I didn't see that was in place. And the other piece of it was I had jumped so completely into that reality that there was almost like no turning back. You know, it's like jumping into the ocean. If you don't know how to swim, the only thing to do is learn to swim in that new environment. And that's what I had to do. There was really no return. I mean, I didn't feel the reality of a return that would support me. It felt fear-based. And here, I faced my ultimate fear, which was the loss of my identity. You know, it was the place everyone said, what a good boy are you? And so with that gone, who are we? So, you know, there was no place to go except back into a frightened way of life, and I knew I couldn't do that.
One of your comments is, fielding the fears of others was probably the most difficult task that you had taken on for this new life, and that you had to confront the fears within yourself first, and you determined that you had to give to others unconditionally and expect absolutely nothing in return.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is a very, very powerful, I feel, a very powerful statement of faith.
Well, you know, if you think about it, you know, many of the reasons we do most of what we do is kind of a response or a reaction to what it is the world either thinks of us or might think if we behave differently. And so, you know, I think we all do a whole lot of projecting. You know, we project our boogeyman and our fears, and we create great enemies in the world, and it's all a lot of projection of our own shadow. So to deal, you know, in a sense, to feel the projections and the fears of others, one would have to first deal with them within ourselves. I mean, if even in our country, if we ourselves would look at our own shadow, we wouldn't be making these great evil enemies outside of ourselves. We would see that, you know, we created this shadow, and the only way to undo it isn't to go kill the rest of the world, but it's to kind of deal with our own shadow and then make friends with the rest of the world. I mean, it's the same personally. I mean, you know, when we step outside of the norm, which, you know, is a kind of agreed upon, fearful way very often, then we're going to have to stand the test of the reason everyone is kind of holding on to that fear, you know, because people want to be free. I mean, we all do, but few of us can do it on our own. And so if anyone attempts it, you're going to get the full blast of everyone's projection. If the miracle sort of comes through for you and you can withstand the onslaught, then I think you, in a sense, we can all, you know, lead the way into greater freedom. And we all do that to some extent, but we can be sure. I mean, you know, most of us set out on a spiritual path and we think it's going to be all pie in the sky and wonderful, but a big part of it is dealing with the difficulty and the loneliness of a one-on-one relationship with the mystery.
Oh, and that, I think, is so difficult for many people to really look at, because it is something that we do want to get caught up in what I call the woo-woo world. And you were face-to-face not only with your own boogeyman, but you also had to sort of release and say, okay, I have to trust somewhere. You met two very special men, Gilbert and Lewis, and they played a very significant part in, I would say, the beginning of your journey, if I'm correct. How did these men have an impact on your life, and what were their gifts to you?
Well, Gilbert and Lewis, Gilbert was this extremely temperamental, creative, brilliant person who had done everything. He was in his 80s when I met him, and I actually met him through Burgess Meredith, the actor, a friend of his. Gilbert had lots of these famous friends. He was just this sort of wild, creative guy. And so in a lot of ways, for Gilbert and Lewis were the people, for, you know, as a young man, outside of my family, I had never known anyone like him. And so, you know, I very much looked up to him and you know, being young. And Lewis, on the other hand, was like a mystic. You know, he was so completely inner. He hardly spoke, but he had this incredible way of seeing reality and defining what was going on in a way that was completely intriguing and powerful. And so it was the combination of the external quality of Gilbert, who was just outrageously, flagrantly creative, and Gilbert's deep inner quality, you know, as of the mystic, that kind of, I felt together they embodied something that was, some, you know, seemed to be a kind of guru for me.
Now, you went through all kinds of extremes. You had given everything away. You had absolutely nothing. And one of your challenges was the dealing with hunger. What was one of your most profound experiences in dealing with that factor of life?
Well, for starters, fasting was very much a part of my life. I fasted once a week since I was 20 years old, and that, you know, was about 12, 15 years into it at that point. I forget how long. So I was accustomed to fasting, and so when I, you know, having given everything up, I never asked anyone for anything, and whatever came, I would accept. And, you know, so that became the process. So I did a lot of, you know, doing without very often. So I think, you know, to me, the most profound experience was, you know, first of all, fearing that possibility, because you're talking basics. I mean, we all sort of head for the stable, as Rumi says, when hunger kicks in, when our body begins, you know, clamoring for attention. And so, you know, the strength of finally actually getting very good at, you know, seeing how the mystery brought into place exactly what I needed, including, you know, not having, would open me up to new experiences of energy, because we all need energy to stay alive and to, you know, to whether it's inspirational energy or physical energy of food. So I, for one thing, I learned a lot about other forms of energy, but I also, I feel the moment I really accepted and took it on as I can do this now is the moment it all changed. And so for me, the most profound experience was actually an experience which I write about in my book, which was coming back to the world of being able to eat whenever I wanted to. And I just knew the moment it happened. It was like it was just one of those things that the moment I was willing to completely, I stopped resisting, stopped fearing, and totally accepted it, it all came back in a, you know, an unexpected way. And I think, you know, to me, it's been sort of the message of the journey. It's all about facing our fear. And once we kind of, instead of spending our lives avoiding the difficult, scary places, the moment we kind of say, okay, if this is what I have to do as a human being on the planet, I see the hand of God in this and I know I can do it. That's the moment we don't have to do it, or we can do it because we want to. It's no longer like something it's no longer our work in a sense. So the most profound experience was really, you know, it was a total experience, was the accepting it and then the miracle of the return of physical nourishment, which I never had to fast again unless I wanted to since that time.
Now, you have a profound story regarding a very violent event that if many people were put in the same situation you had been put into, it might have ended up in a very negative, ugly situation. It was transformational in its own way, and your story is titled Saved by the Divine Feminine. For those of you who are listening to me this morning, my guest is Jerry Winstrom. His wonderful book is The Inspired Heart. He is a professional artist. He lives on Whidbey Island in the Pacific Northwest, the state of Washington. This is his story of a personal journey that he took 15 years to experience. And it transformed his life and his thinking, and I think it also deeply affected his art. This particular conflict, and by the way, we have one book to give away today, one book. If you'd like to call in and get a free copy, it's 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227 if you'd like a free copy. Now, Jerry, this story about the confrontation with the gang, would you share that with us?
Yes. There are actually several stories in the book that, you know, where I think when we turn into trusting life completely without interference, all of our fears come up. So I think this particular fear, you know, we all have, you know, of being in a violent situation, how do we survive it? Or what, you know, or should, you know, fear would tell us to do something other than maybe where our actual salvation lies.
Now, this is Bob Raisins.
Yes. So this story, you know, because at the time I had given everything up and my time was my own, I would come and go as I pleased. I didn't sleep a lot. So sometimes late at night I would go for walks or, you know, it just didn't matter. I had a loft on the Hudson River, so I would often go down to the river. And on this particular night it was very late and I decided to go for a walk. And walking by the local YMCA, there was a gang hanging out on the stoop and they were drinking. And they were mostly men, but there were a few women in the gang. And so I walked by, and as I walked by, one of the men approached, who appeared to be the ringleader, and he said, "Hey, got a cigarette?" And I said, "No, I don't smoke." And I kept going. I just was walking. And as I got quite a ways down the street, he called to me, and he says, "Hey, come back here." And so, you know, so that was sort of the first moment. You know, I you know, they were being mischievous. I mean, I knew something energetically was not, you know, very comfortable about the situation. And so that was a moment where I had to decide, am I going to give in to fear and keep walking, or am I going to trust this moment completely? And so deciding as I did with my everything that came, I walked back. And so when I got back, he had a cigarette between his teeth, and he said, "Got a match?" And I said, "No, don't have a match." And I walked again. I kept walking. So this time a little further down the street, he called me back again. And the same moment, you know, but I was committed at that point. So I turned and I walked back. And he said, "What do you have?" So I used to carry these little boxes of Superman brand raisins for the local children. You know, when they saw me coming, they'd always run and get their box of raisins. So I had pockets full of these things in my jacket. So I put a box of raisins in front of each of the men sitting on the stoop and gave him a box, and I walked away. And so as I got way down the road, I heard the raisins hitting the street. You know, they were throwing them. And so he said, "Hey, get back here." So again, that moment of fear or trust, and I turned and walked back. And at that point, they surrounded me. And very angrily, and right in my face, the ringleader kind of said, "Who do you think you are? What are you doing giving me these raisins? Or why are you giving me these raisins?" And I just went inward. You know, I said, "Well, here I am, God. You know, here's the moment. What?" And being able to just take that second to go inward, I was able to access, you know, I grew up in a poor, mostly black neighborhood. These were all young black men. And I was, you know, having grown up in that neighborhood, I felt the anger and the difficulty of the young black man in America. And I was just able to access that place of deep compassion and love, really. And I just simply said, but I think more than what I said was the energy, the place it came from was such compassion, and I genuinely felt it. I said I was just trying to be kind. And when I said it, it like completely disempowered him. The women jumped up from the stoop, and they surrounded me, and they said to the rest, and they said, "You leave him be." They said, "You be on your way. They don't mean you no harm." And so I turned and walked away. But as I turned, I sort of looked at the ringleader, and I just saw this look of pain go across his face, because the women he wanted to impress actually had defected and came out to support me. So he kind of blew his very reason for trying to be such a tough guy. So it was really a moment of transformation for all of us. Me, because I faced my worst fear, and them, because they saw that what they thought was this, you know, power of the gang was completely disempowered by a kind of innocent moment rather than a more aggressive moment. So I think we all learned something in that moment.
You have so much in your book that would touch the heart and mind of just about anybody who would read it. Why was it important for you to put this book into form with the format of all of these different experiences? What is the gift you want to give to the readers of this book?
Well, you know, over the years, I've always had a story of those experiences, and it's sort of we all have a kind of personal mythos that unfolds usually not to our plan, but just moments that define our lives. And in a lot of ways, my book represents many of those moments of just real transforming moments. And, you know, and so I always had a story that, you know, which are the stories in the book that seem to help people. And at one point in my life, you know, I have a big 2,000 square foot space here full of my art. And, you know, we really literally have hundreds of people, you know, over the years coming here and visiting and people bringing their difficulties and troubles. And I've been talking to so many people one-on-one. I really got to the place where I was tired of my own story and my own stories, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And it was exactly at that moment that I was approached by a publisher and asked if I would write a book, because there was a Parabola video. There is a Parabola video called In the Hands of Alchemy, put out by Parabola magazine, about my art and life. So my publisher had seen the video, and she wondered if I had a book, which I didn't. So she thought, you know, this would make a great book. So it was, you know, the timing. I was approached by a publisher. I didn't have to, like, find a publisher. I didn't have to write a book for no reason at all. It was all right in line. And so I just felt the perfection of that moment. And I went with it. And the stories, I wrote the book in 4 months. It was incredibly easy. It was more like downloading it from, you know, from my experience. It was, you know, I had to learn how to use a computer because I didn't even know how to turn the computer on or didn't know how to type. But in 4 months, I produced this book, which, you know, it took 20 years to live out. But it was easy to just sort of access it. And what do I hope to do? I hope that the stories do what they've always done. You know, places where people have always come to me with their fears, I had a story that said, I know about that fear because I had it too. And here's what I have found out about it. And here's the way to trust. And it's not, I don't think people need to do what I did, but I think we're all in the best seat in the house. If we can just be with each moment in our own lives, there's no better position to be other than exactly where we are, no matter what the circumstances. And I think, you know, the message of the book is simply be where you are and trust even the most terrifying moments, that there's some bit of magic in that will give it all deeper meaning and liberate you from the fear that if we avoid it, we will continue to live out. I mean, that was one of the things, even with your earlier question about, you know, how was I able to do it so long? I didn't see an alternative. I saw that if I were to give in to any one of the fears that came up, it would just be a way of life. Living in fear would become a way of life. However intelligently I finessed it, that would be the premise, and I knew that, and there was no returning to that. And that's, I hopefully, is the gift of the book. And it appears to be working because I've heard from many people since the book has been out. And the film is about that as well. I mean, it's a similar story, but it, you know, there's a lot more imagery of the new art and that kind of thing.
You have a wonderful story out of your book from the Hindus. I really like it. You believe it's from the Hindu myth, the legacy of the Hindu people. And it reads like this: once a very determined spiritual seeker went to see a very great guru who was also a king. The guru was a holy fool. Upon seeing the determination of this young seeker, he instructed the woman to walk through his entire castle. She was told not to miss a single room. The castle was a dark and beautiful place, and she'd need a light to see it all. She was given an oil lamp that was filled to the very brim with oil and was told that it was the most important thing not to spill a single drop. And the young seeker, intuiting the spiritual significance of the task, was extremely careful with the very full lamp, After several hours of walking with great seriousness of purpose through the entire castle, she finally returned to the king, feeling she had accomplished the difficult assignment he had given her. She said, "I managed to go through every single room without spilling a single drop of oil." The king said, "Very good. But tell me, did you enjoy the beauty of my castle?" The young woman said, "No. How could I? I was focused on the oil and was being very careful not to spill it. I didn't notice a thing." The king said, "Then you have failed the test." You know, I think, Jerry, you have not failed the test. You passed the test.
Well, I almost failed a few times.
Well, of course. But without going through the experience that you chose. This isn't something that's forced on you. This is something you chose.
Well,
I think that as a human being, you've got a lot to offer, number one. And number two, your artwork is just incredible. I'd like to ask you, do you have a website that people can go to find out more about your art and your story?
Yes, we have this wonderful young woman who works for Microsoft, brought in all of her friends, and they created this amazing website as a gift to us. It's called, the web link is handsofalchemy.com, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y. Hands of Alchemy. And that's also the name of the parabola video about my art and life is in the hands of alchemy.
Great. All right. Now, Jerry's website, and you can view a lot of his art, and there's a piece in here that's one of my favorites. It's the one of Marilyn's Dream. I just love it because it has the fox and the mystical feel to it and the beautiful portrait of this very special lady who is in your life, and I really think it's just exquisite. His website is handsofalchemy.com. His wonderful book, The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. This is a book that brings to you, the reader, the gift of someone's journey and their feelings of their own personal experience that come from the heart, the mind, and the essence of who Jerry Wenstrom is. And his last name is spelled W-E-N-N-S-T-R-O-M. And this is his journey, his real-life journey of transformation. Before we close out the interview, Jerry, do you have a thought you would like to leave my audience with?
Well, yes, maybe I do. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, you know, people, you know, it's like you say, and like you said earlier, like I chose this journey. In many ways, I think our challenges in life, none of us would necessarily choose. What I did was become a willing participant in the inevitable in a lot of ways, you know. I may have chosen the form, but I think it was inevitable. But I think the essence of what I would like to, one more thing to what the journey has been about, is it's not necessarily about will, intelligence, and good intentions. It's about grace. And I think we can only experience that grace when we allow ourselves to be completely vulnerable. And even when we allow ourselves to be in a place that looks and feels like failure and death, I mean, that's the place grace comes through. And if it didn't, you might say we wouldn't need God. We wouldn't need the mystery to carry the journey. And so, you know, I think what we can do as human beings is meet the gods halfway with courage as much as possible. And it doesn't take a lot. It just takes being in our own lives completely. But I think ultimately also knowing it's not about perfection. It's not about will and effort and all the things that we think we're about. It's about humble asking, and it's ultimately about the grace that comes through.
Jerry Wenstrom has been my guest. His wonderful book again, The Inspired Heart, His Journey of Transformation, 15 years of life that he passes along to you. You don't have to do the same thing he did, but you can benefit from his gifts of insight, wisdom, grace, and perspective. Jerry, thank you so much for being my guest this morning.
Thank you, Donna, very much.
It's been a pleasure. Donna Sebo here. Remember, one free book to give away. Give us a call at 877-876-5227. You're listening to The Donna Sebo Show on bbsradio.com. Don't you go away. We've got more good things to share with you this morning. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and if you'd like to get a free copy of the book, The Inspired Heart, then just give us a call at 877-876-5227, Also, don't forget, if you would like to call in and chat with me and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, I'm also delighted to do that. And the same number is the place that you call, 877-876-5227. And all I'll need from you is your first name or your initial, and then let me tell you what my mind shows. And then after that, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that you like. And I mean that exactly. Anything you like. You know, sometimes I find when people want to gain insight into their lives, they're afraid of asking direct questions. And you shouldn't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid to ask a question. What's the worst thing that could happen? Maybe I'd tell you I didn't know. But you never know what kind of insight that you will get. So don't be afraid to ask a direct question. Again, 877-876-5227. Last night, I had the opportunity to watch a wonderful program on animals, and it was about extraordinary animals. And, of course, having had animals in our own family and being around so many people who are pet lovers, whether they love snakes, rabbits, gophers, dogs, cats, I don't care, birds, everyone seems to have a story to tell about their pets. And one of the aspects of the programming that I was watching last night was dealing with animals that are like service animals and animals that did something exceptional to save the lives of their owners. And I thought I would share a couple of those stories with you. Now, this is all about a cat. And this was a shelter cat. This is a cat that saved a woman, a man's life. In fact, it was Gary Rushing. And he was really, really in love with this cat. And this cat had some problems having been in the shelter. But Gary really loved this animal. There's just an immediate bond. And he said it was just so very, very special to him, the love the animal gave him. And he was going to do an experiment with his cat. And he thought, you know what? I'm disabled. I have some problems with many strokes that have affected me, and I have this strange effect that occurs with my heart. I wonder if I could train my cat to dial 911. So what he did, he started acting out as if he was hurt, and he took his cat's paw, showed it how to knock the receiver off, and hit the right speed dial button, which would automatically dial 911. And he did this exercise with this beautiful little tabby that he called Tommy. And he did this more than once, and he didn't even think it was going to work. Well, Gary had to be in a wheelchair. And there was this one evening when he was shifting from his wheelchair into bed, and he crashed. Automatically, he called out for help, and he was hurt, but of course, nobody was hearing him. There was a nurse that was due to check on him, but not until the morning. So he'd end up laying on the floor the whole night, and he'd also miss some of his medication that was mandatory for him to take. And all of a sudden, he heard someone pounding on his door, and he heard the word police. And he cried out, they opened the door, and they then told him something that totally shocked him. He said, we got a 911 call. It was his cat Tommy. Tommy, when this accident happened with Gary, had remembered what Gary had taught him, and had knocked the phone off and hit the button that activated the 911 call. So Tommy rescued him. Now, that's not the only story that I have in front of me. This is a story about Thor and a gal by the name of Sally Benson. Now, Sally Benson did not pick her dog. He was in a litter of 13 puppies, and as soon as she spied him, he saw her, and he left that litter and came running over to her. She said, he chose me. Well, now she took him home. And her stepdad was very, very sick, and so she was often running errands for him. Now, Thor is a German pincher. She decided she was going to train Thor to dial 911. Now, this is how she did it. She dabbed a little peanut butter on the speed dial button, and she said, if someone falls, press this. So she repeated this command to Thor over and over again. Now, her stepdad eventually passed away, and she moved, but she kept practicing with Thor. Now, Sally was a diabetic, and she thought that if ever there were an emergency, it would be a good idea to have Thor trained to call 911. Now, there came the time when an emergency situation with her condition of diabetes evolved. She was checking her blood sugar and found that it was triple of what it should be. Now, immediately, she knew what she was supposed to do. She injected herself with insulin, and then she realized, as she was reacting to the insulin, her monitor that she had used to test her sugar was broken. Her sugar had not been high at all. She was going into insulin shock. Everything went black on her. Then she seemed to hear a noise out of a door. Now remember, she totally blacked out. She was feeling very groggy. Police were at her front door. She managed to call out to them, said, we've gotten a 911 call. She said, I didn't call. Well, they managed to get inside. And the dispatcher, she found out later, had gotten a call, and apparently Thor had gotten to the phone, and all he did was pant on the phone. That's all he did. What else could he do? He's a dog. They said they knew he was in danger. She was in danger. Someone was in danger. And they called, and they traced the call, and they found out where she was. And she said, my dog knew I needed help, and he did what I'd trained him to do. Animals are incredible. I think we need to remember there are times that they can sense things that we don't have a clue about. I mentioned that I had watched the program about the search and rescue dogs and other dogs that when they also had dogs on therapy and dogs that were trained to deal with people with disabilities and to respond accordingly. Animals have a sensory system that many times is thousands of times much more effective than our own. And they understand a lot. Just because they can't talk the way we talk doesn't mean they don't think, they don't feel, and they don't perceive. And often they've found with those that have this special sensory capability, they're able to detect people when they're getting ready to go into a seizure, have a stroke, go into shock, they know in advance. Wonderful, wonderful stories are related to this. So if you have an animal, understand that they are capable of doing more than what you realize. And they may be able to save your life, just like Tommy, the tabby, saved Gary, and Thor, well, that wonderful German pincher, he saved Sally. These stories, they do happen. They're not make-believe. And just remember, you can do the same. Now, what if you want to teach your pet? Now, here is some information from a veterinarian, Roland Tripp. He said, if you want to train your pet, get a clicker. And this is a training tool that's sold at most pet stores. It's only like a buck and a half. And you can get it from any pet store. And use a phone with a large speed dial button. And place it on the floor unplugged. And once your pet is trained, you then plug it in and the program the speed dial to 911. So you use the phone disconnected first, and then you train them. Start the training. Now, these are the steps. One, click the clicker once and give your pet a treat every time he, one, gets closer to the phone, two, touches the receiver, three, pushes the phone off the hook. Also, the next time he pushes the phone, don't give him a treat until he approaches the speed dial. Then click and give a treat. Continue until he can complete the whole trick. And then put away the clicker and use the command, dial 911. When he completes the whole trick on command, click and give three treats. Or you might want to do what Sally did, or not what Sally did, what Gary did is use some peanut butter. Just use some peanut butter. That might be something, too. But regardless, animals can be trained, and that can benefit somebody, and maybe even someone that you love. Donna Sebo here. Telephone lines are open. If you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, give me a call at 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. I want to also let you know about my guest that's going to, well, actually, my guest for the rest of this week. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about quantum success. Bobby D. Porter is going to be our guest. Then we're going to be talking with Dr. Robert Zeev on Wednesday about healthy medicine. Medicine, the world of medicine, is changing, and it's changing because we as consumers, we're saying we want the changes, and there's a lot of good people out there that are willing to do it. We're going to be talking about Crazy Horse, a man well-known in history, another place, another time, with Coral Montana, who is in Australia, and then the Lois Wilson story with Bill Borchette. She was the wife of Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking a break. Don't you go away. We're going to be back with more good things to share. Have that pad of paper handy. You're going to need it. Hi, this is Donna Sebo, 877-876-5227. If you'd like to chat with me today, and be sure and let your friends know about the Donna Sebo Show. Also, remember, on BBS Radio, we have a lot of different programming, and shows are going, are archived already. I've had some inquiries about the shows for June. Well, the staff has been putting in a lot of equipment, and they're just going through so many levels of introduction and refinement of the broadcasting operation. So we're going to get those archives on as soon as we can. But meanwhile, just remember there's so much to share and to interact with. Tell your friends about the Donna Sebo Show. We're on every morning Pacific Coast time from 11 until noon, and always delighted to share that time with you. I wanted to give out a wonderful recipe this morning, and I don't know about you, but I have a sweet tooth, and sometimes you want to fix something, you really want to fix something yummy, but you don't have a lot of time. How about a cheesecake? That's one of my absolute favorite desserts, but this is a no-bake cheesecake flan. Bit of surprise, this one is absolutely delicious, and this particular recipe does have some alcohol in it, but if you want to substitute orange juice for the brandy, you can do that. Now, this is what you're going to need. It's so easy. All you're going to need is an envelope of unflavored gelatin, an envelope of unflavored gelatin. That's about a quarter of an ounce. You're going to need a quarter of a cup of brandy, a quarter of a cup of brandy, 3 packages, 8 ounces each of cream cheese at room temperature. So just put it out plenty of times. Get busy doing other stuff, then it'll come into room temperature very nicely. You need 1 can of sweetened condensed milk. 1 can of sweetened condensed milk. You need 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, 2.5 cups of thawed frozen whipped topping, and then 3/4 cup of jarred caramel topping. Now, if you want to make your own caramel topping, you could do that too, however you want it to go. And I'm telling you, this is going to really knock your sweet tooth into happy land. Okay, now this is how easy it is. You're going to need a 9-inch springform pan with, and you want to spray it with some cooking spray. And then in a small microwave bowl, you want to sprinkle the gelatin over the brandy. Now remember, if you don't like brandy, then you can have some orange juice instead. Maybe even try lemon juice, whatever you want in flavor, but you have that option. And then you let the juice and or the brandy stand with the gelatin until it's softened, and that's going to take about 5 minutes. And then what you want to do is microwave it on high in 5-second intervals, stirring it each time until the gelatin dissolves. Now, at medium-high speed in your mixer, beat your cream cheese. That's 3 packages of your cream cheese, your milk, your vanilla, until it's smooth and creamy. That's going to take about 2 to 3 minutes. You can just put it all in the mixer and just turn the machine on and let it do its work. And then, because your brandy and gelatin or orange juice, whichever you choose, you're then going to, after that's nice and smooth and creamy, you're going to gradually beat in that liquid mixture. And then after that's blended nicely, you just want to fold in your whipped topping. And then you spoon the batter into the pan. And you cover and you refrigerate it until it's set, at least 8 hours. And depending on your refrigerator, if it, you know, this is the warm time of the year, and so often refrigerator doors are opening in and out. Make this the day before so it can really have a chance to get nice and firm. And then when you're ready to serve it, just run the knife around the edge of the pan to loosen, remove the side of the pan, place this wonderful no-bake cheesecake flan on a serving plate, and you will find it's just wonderful, and you take your caramel topping and pour it over the top. And if you didn't want the caramel, you might want to use some delicious preserves or something like that that you can put on. You are going to be the person that makes the choices on that. And by the way, for the best flavors, what you want to do is remove your cheesecake flan at least an hour, or maybe, depending on how warm it is, I'd say 45 minutes to an hour before you're ready to serve it. And that way, all of those delicious flavorings of the vanilla, the brandy, or the orange juice, whatever you use, will have a chance to really smooth itself out. And as I said, it's going to be absolutely wonderful. This is Donna Sebo. I know we're almost out of time here, so I thought I would share with you quickly before we close out the show. And don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about quantum success. Yes, we're going to be getting some insights from Mr. DePorter, who will have a lot to share. How about saving some money? Are any of you interested in that? Well, what is the old adage? A penny saved is a penny earned. There's a number of different suggestions that Michelle Jones has put together. Very simple things. Write emails instead of sending a card. Although I'll tell you something, I have to add something in here. I love to send cards. There's something magical about sending a thank you card or anything like that by regular mail. I know it costs some money, but that's okay. It's just that magical touch. Very, very nice. But use email. That saves you postage. And you just want to remember, use good sense by shopping around with credit cards for a better rate. And you can make a big difference in what you're paying out by just lowering the interest charge by as much, as little as a percentage or more. Also, if you are a big soda drinker, switch to iced tea. Make your own, and you'll save some money there. Also, save on dry cleaning. Stretch your time between dry cleanings by using an at-home dry cleaning kit. And then when it comes to medicines or different product items, try generic. They might save you up to 50%. And fix your own pizza at home. Pick a bargain bank. Box up leftovers. Donate to charity. Bake cakes at home. Choose matinees when you go to the movies. And, you know, maybe your cell phone. Maybe you have to have a smaller plan with that. And don't be afraid to haggle for a bargain. Those are just some tips that Michelle sent along, and I want to say it's been an absolute delight being with you this morning. And remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. When I think of Jerry Winstrom, my guest this morning, his journey was one that took him into many different adventures. And we all have an opportunity to experience adventure and choose our journeys as we think we need to choose them. Sometimes, though, we might have some surprises in store. So don't forget, today has a journey all of its own that's going to express itself in its own special way for you. Trust and release. Make it okay to enjoy your journey. Donna Sebo here. Talk to you tomorrow. Have a fabulous day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.